basically, let's just start by having you explain what the Homeland Invasion Tour is all about.
Okay. I went to school to be a visual artist, and I did gallery shows back in Akron, Ohio, before a band that I was part of.
Name of band left unsaid.
Yeah, better left unsaid. We got together quite a while ago, right after the shooting of the Kent State students. We were up there when it happened, and they closed down our school, so we were a friend of mine who was in the art department. We started a band right about then, and we were still art students, and then something accidentally happened, and the band kind of took off, and although I was still doing art every day, visual art, and the other guys in the band, we did all the artwork and all the graphics, and we made little films and things like that that were all visual projects, you know. Music was still kind of the main thrust of what was happening, but I kept a diary drawn, because I was traveling all over the world at the time. I kept a diary on the back of postcards, and it was drawings and collages and written things, and I used to send them out, and then after a while they just started collecting in my suitcases, and I started putting them in binding them in volumes, and that's become my you know, it's sort of my art form for the last 30 years, I guess.
That's cool.
Has been doing these observations.
Right.
Mostly visual. And my day job still involves music. I write music for feature films. But I've found ways to work in during the day so that I can still get my first love, which is printmaking. I can still do drawings and sketches and end up making prints during the day at my recording studio. It's also an art studio.
Oh, really?
So if I'm working on a movie with Wes Anderson, I can write a bunch of music for a few hours in the morning, and then my engineer can come in and start mixing on it and working on it. And that gives me an excuse to go out of the room for a couple hours and work with printing up the artwork that you're seeing in the show at Views.
Cool. So what kind of studio do you have set up there? I mean, I know about the music studio, obviously it's probably pretty elaborate, but I'm talking specifically in terms of the art studio. What do you have there?
I have printing facilities and just an area where I can paint and draw.
Cool.
There's a lot of rooms. The building's circular. It was built in the 60s, and it's shaped kind of like it's built in the 70s, I mean. It was shaped kind of like a birth control container. It's shaped like a old birth control pills container.
Right.
Or a Mayan calendar or something, where all the rooms are pie wedges.
Right.
Going around in a circle. So you know, it's easy to just move out of one room and slip into the next door.
Nice. So,
I did shows kind of intermittently. I did gallery shows over the last 20 years all over the world. I did group shows with Southern California artists for a while in the late 80s, early 90s with people like George Ann Dean and Robert Williams and Gary Pandrew, who now kind of probably is an East Coast artist, but we were friends back in the old days.
Yeah.
When he lived over here. And
so most of those artists that you seem to align with are probably, I don't know, I think the sort of common vernacular for those guys nowadays is kind of lowbrow artists.
There's something similar there.
Yeah.
And they were gracious enough to drag me along on the tours. they were doing. So that was, it worked out good for all of us.
Yeah.
And then I did some solo shows in the 80s, late 80s and then early 90s, but I had started this company where I was doing music for film and TV, and that was like making it so it was impossible for me to go downtown and screen print, because I was on the other side of town in West Hollywood music during the day, and you know, and there'd be no time to sleep if I was trying to do it both. So I found a way to move the studio in here, and
so now you've just got this big art multiplex, like music media and art media, and you do it all together.
Yeah, so it's all in the same building. It's just kind of mixed. It's like those Reese's peanut butter cups, you know.
Nice.
And so then the home invasion was, of course, you know, kind of, you know, a little bit kind of a mutation of what's going on in the news. And kind of an interest in what makes people do the things they do, including blow themselves up and blow other people up.
Yeah, I noticed in the Few show there seemed to be a lot of imagery of women in Muslim shrouds and little guys running around with bombs and little, like, people doing things in secret and stuff like that. I was wondering if you could talk about the political content of these daily compositions.
You know, I just, it's you know, it's interesting what's going on in the world, because there's so many ways to think about life and ways to think about existence, and some of them, you know, it's like conceptually you can kind of separate yourself from your experience and put yourself in somebody else's experience and imagine them doing why they do things they do and why they make the choices they do and what their desires are and what their needs are. And sometimes it's near impossible, and sometimes it's like the news that you're getting from the media is just inadequate to really make any kind of a judgment on what's happening in the world around you.
Right.
You know, it's like, especially if you travel around the world, you see one thing, you know, splashed all over international television sets, but it changes radically when you go from country to country. And if you go to a country where there's a lot of Arabic television stations, for instance, they're living in a different world than we are. It's like a parallel universe, because their interpretations of things are, and what the meanings are, totally different than what we think is happening.
Right. And so how do you filter that into these drawings?
The drawings are just sort of, in a way, it's snapshot and its responses to imagery and the news that we get bombarded with every day.
Right.
Just kind of, you know, it's a response. It's trying to find another way to make something tangible that seems intangible and hard to understand, you know.
Right. So how do you feel like? Well, I mean, I know that, you know, in Devo you had a pretty at that point a, you know, kind of subversive message about society sort of in decline and de-evolution and all those ideas that
were. Well, it seemed subversive at the time. I mean, in reality, we got a lot of people angry by saying, "Oh, the world's falling. Things aren't evolving, they're devolving, things are falling apart," and people would get really upset and tell us we had a bad attitude.
Right.
Now you'd say something to somebody about de-evolution, and they just laugh and go, "Yeah, you know, things are falling apart, aren't they?"
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you about. How does that change?
It's like, it is different now, and things are, are coming apart at the seams.
Yeah.
People that, you know, people that would argue it, only the most obtuse humans on the planet could not be afraid of
of
what's coming along in the immediate future.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think a lot of, for me, a lot of that had to do with just being in New York when it happened and seeing the impact of it directly, whereas in other countries, like you said, you've got a totally different perspective because things like that happen every day and they're very commonplace. And I'm sure for you as a student at Kent State when the shootings happened, that that impact hit you then probably pretty clearly. What can you say about that? I mean, was it a way that you sort of formed the ideas behind?
I think, you know, it was just, you know, I think Devo and, you know, by extrapolation, everything that any of us that were in Devo, because we created the band together, I think all the artwork we do today is still permutations of the same basic theme, and that is, you know, Devo was... We were anti-stupidity and pro-information, but we were also concerned about the downward spiral and if there was a way to, you know, to ever envision the futures that were imagined back in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s.
Yeah.
Those futures seem to have been demolished in possibility. It's we have a lot of the same enemies, you know, religion, greed, you know, that has existed through time, but, you know, it, although people are somewhat more docile than they were 500 years ago,
mm-hmm.
I think there's so much more, collaboration and working together that's necessary than what really happens on this planet, that it will probably get much uglier before things ever look good, if they ever do.
Yeah. Just to shift gears, let's talk about the process of these drawings a little bit. I was really interested in reading your artist statement to know that, you know, what you said before earlier about these drawings, that you do them every day and that you have for 30 years. And I think your gallery director, Michael Pilmer, told me that he's got a library of something like 25,000 of these things. And that's really amazing to me because I recently started challenging myself to do a drawing a day. And it's tough. Some days I just really don't feel like it. Some days I do four or five. And you said the same sort of thing, like some days you really get rolling and you do a lot. Talk to me a little bit about that process and what sort of brings you to the postcards and how have you sustained that through the amazing amount of stuff that you do musically.
Yeah, postcards, it seemed they kind of found themselves. It dates me, you know,
yeah.
The fact that I have an interest in postcards. Because, I mean, postcards will be, I think, totally irrelevant in the next few years. You know, because who in the hell would choose to send something by a postcard? You know, there's much better ways to send messages. There's ways to send them so they're private, too, much more private than postcards. Postcards, you kind of had to share with anybody who looked at it along the way.
That's true.
You know, you could, like, talk about your kitty litter eating fetish and at the bottom of it. because the postman was kind of... be looking at it, and who knows who he'd share it with on the post office and look at left.
Have you done that for Shits and Giggles?
I've experimented with sending things through the mail to see what the limitations were.
Yeah.
But I did that in the 70s when it was actually quite liberal times, and you could even do things like, I experimented with things like just even taking like a corner off of a U.S. stamp and putting like 3/4 of a foreign stamp, carefully cutting them together so that you were making up phony postage stamps.
Nice.
And send them, and then I also just sent, you know, absurd or or maybe cult, you know, like a socially deemed out scene artwork.
Yeah.
Through the mail to stretch things, and some of it, sometimes things didn't make it, but most of the time it did.
If they didn't make it, where do you think they went?
I suppose there were probably some lockers that, you know, at the post office where, you know, a couple of the guys that, you know, went and started out on their route, and then, or else the sorters maybe get them first, you know, so the sorters, you know, they go, I'll hang on to this one for a day or two, and then it's on the locker.
Makes me want to get a job at the post office.
I know. Well, but, you know, the downside is you'd have to look at so much junk mail.
That's true.
On the way there, you know.
Yeah.
It's depressing, just all the, between realtors and Great Expectations.
Yeah.
The people who send out brochures to join their dating service, you know, it's like,
yeah.
Those two companies alone could make it so you'd never be able to, Pizza Hut, coupons.
Yeah, well, that's what would make it great, though, because every once in a while somebody like you would send through something. Like, I've got my laptop here, and I'm looking at this image that you drew of this kind of fat guy with a beret on who's got a duck for a dick, and he's kind of screaming, and the penis duck, that is. I'd love to see some of that, like, come through the mail. It's hilarious.
Yeah, because the truth is, if you go to the mailbox, and you're almost, it's repellent.
Yeah.
It's like spam is bad, but it's worse when you have to touch it.
Yeah. So how does all this stuff affect
anyhow,
what,
so,
yeah.
When I was a kid, you know, I liked postcards and I was very myopic when I was young. As a matter of fact, I was so myopic I was legally, I still am. I have what's called legal blindness, where it's corrective blindness. If my vision couldn't be corrected, I probably wouldn't be able to find doorways. I can't see the biggie on the eye chart with
right.
my glasses. And so, at a very young age, I was drawing, you know, and had my nose 2 inches from a piece of paper to draw. And so, rather than being one of those artists that did the big, gigantic pieces, I became more. I don't know, it became more comfortable for me to always stay in a smaller format. And then once the band started traveling, started playing places, it just was a nice convenient form, you know.
Yeah.
And I had sent things to, there was a couple famous mail art people back then, a place called Ant Farm, and there was out in San Francisco was a woman named Irene Dogmatic, and then Ray Johnson and Andy Warhol. There were different people that did trade mail art, and so I would send things to them and quite often get responses, so it encouraged me to keep doing. That's how I kind of started on postcards, was by mailing things to other people that were mail artists.
That's cool.
Then the form just was nice. It was nice to be able to have something in my pocket, and
yeah.
when it, you know, you're on tour with your band, and there's a lot. It's most of the day is very boring when you're in a band. It's and you're touring. There's about 2 hours that are great when you're on stage.
Yeah.
And then there's a chance like once or twice a week there'll be a cool party afterwards. But for the yeah. most part, it's like you're at like backstage. You're at sound check. You're in an airport. You're on a bus.
Yeah.
You're in a taxi. And
well, no wonder you have so many then.
So it's boring. So it's like those are the kind of things you can like pull out a 3x5 or 4x6 card out of your pocket, draw it and paint, and you can go to another place while you're sitting there in a radio station in Wisconsin waiting for a guy to make jokes about comparing, you know, whippet and masturbation.
Right.
Over the air.
God, that must have been tedious. So do you think these things are therapeutic in any way as a result of having to deal with assholes like that?
Well, I you know, first off, all my urges to own a handgun or to use a handgun
yeah.
have been totally sublimated.
Well, that's good.
I've never considered seriously ever strapping a dynamite around my waist and blowing somebody else up. I didn't like the where the fence ran between their house and my house.
Yeah.
I've never thought about taking a machete and cutting anyone's limbs off. I think it helped me quite a bit.
Yeah.
I don't ever get sucked into road rage or.
Well, I think Osama bin Laden should start drawing postcards then.
I don't ever sue people.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
Well, everybody's got to find their own thing, you know.
Yeah.
The postcards worked. I'm lucky because that's a cheap one.
Yeah, definitely.
Because people tend to, most of the postcards that are out there in the world, people look at them once or twice and then they get rid of them, so.
Yeah.
That's a good selling place for me. And then I just became, in the last 6 or 7 years, it slowly trickled in until it's like hit me big in the last 2 or 3. I became really interested in finding other people's postcards,
mm-hmm.
especially older ones,
yeah.
with innocuous or mysterious or whatever kind of messages that they had left on their postcards, and then using that for a canvas rather than starting with a blank piece of paper.
I noticed that some of them had writing underneath them. It looked like really sort of like early 20th century kind of like handwriting, like what I'd find on my like grandmother's letters to my grandfather before they got married or something like that. Like,
yeah, I love that old calligraphy.
Yeah.
See, that's the kind of stuff that dates me, you know. That's my anti-bling bling side.
Or something. Nice.
I don't know. It's the other side that besides the side that loves plastic, which there is a side of me that loves plastic and wearing red plastic hats and yellow plastic boots.
Well, yeah. Well, that's always going to be futuristic, though, you know. So, tell me about Andy Warhol. You said you did some things with him. I was sort of interested in that interaction because I read an interview, I can't remember what interview it was, it might have been in Mean Magazine or something like that a few years ago, where you talked about the divide between commercial art versus fine art, and you said that...
He was an influence, yeah.
Yeah, you said that you were influenced by Andy Warhol and Roy Lichtenstein. Did you ever have a chance to hang out with Andy Warhol?
I had one really bad experience with Andy Warhol.
Oh.
Yeah, this was back before Devo had a record deal yet, but we had Prestige Records in Akron, Ohio.
Uh-huh.
And we had 3 singles we put out on. And it was like Mongoloid and Giacomo was one of them. And
yeah.
B-Stiff was one of them. And then there was, we did a cover of the Rolling Stones Satisfaction.
Right.
So we had these 3 singles we did. And you know, nobody saw them in the U.S. But they did get the Bleecker Bobs in New York City. And
yeah.
And a guy from a record company in England, Stiff Records, Dave Robinson, he was in there looking for stuff, you know. And he picked them up and took them back to England with him. And the next time he came back to town, he called us up and said, "Hey, you guys, I could, if you let me distribute these records for you in Europe," and we, you know, because we said we didn't want to sign a record deal with anybody, but he said he would just distribute those 3 singles the way we did them. He said he could sell a bunch. We were like, really? Okay. So he took them in, and it was kind of funny because within 4 months of him taking the 3 singles, 5 of the, out of those 3 songs, 3 singles, 5-6 sides all charted in Europe all at the same time.
Wow.
Mongoloid was number 1 in France at the same time. Satisfaction was in the top 10 in England, and it was number 1 in Yugoslavia. Jaco Homo was in the top 10, and was in the top 40, but that was good enough for us. Just in Scotland, and we thought, how good could that be? That's better than reality. Jaco Homo in Scotland, top 40, and B-Stiff was on the charts in Germany all at the same time. So there was this. Interest in Europe where they were like, hey, they're not only weird, they're commercial.
Yeah.
You know, so then we had all the different record people were trying to decide, why am I telling you this part that was...
About Warhol.
Oh, Warhol, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, yeah, so once when I was in New York, just kind of, and he came to a Devo show.
Uh-huh.
And so afterwards, it was like, want to go out sometime? So I was like, okay. So, yeah, one of the girls was in one of his movies, who's now a publicist, I think. What was her name? I want to say her last name, Bloom.
I can't remember her name.
It doesn't matter. It was one of her actresses, his actresses. And she at the time was working at Columbia Records, and they were interested in signing Devo. And so she was going to be my date, and I was all excited. So she came over and picked me up at, like, Gramercy Park Hotel or something. Or,
right.
And we were on, like, a triple date with, well, it was a double date. It was Michael Jackson. It was just, he had just finished doing The Wiz.
Nice.
He still had big hair and a big nose, and he was still a black man.
Nice.
And he had patched suede pants and a big apple hat.
Yeah.
And it was him and Andy Warhol, and then this guy in bib overalls who was, looked like Little Abner.
Uh-huh.
I can't remember the guy's name. I just remember that Andy would, like, the guy had a bare chest and just bib overalls on over, and he would put his hand under the guy's bib,
uh-huh,
on his bib overalls, and like kind of like fuss with the hair on his chest and go, whatever the guy's name, Roberto's going to be a star. And
did he put him in his movies and stuff?
Roberto would go, Andy's going to make me a movie star, you know. And,
oh boy.
You know, they took me to Club 54, which I'd never been to before.
Yeah.
Heard of. And it was a little intimidating because I was, at the time, I was living out of a suitcase. I didn't have an apartment. I didn't have a car. I didn't have a job.
Yeah.
I was just trying to, you know, make this art music happen. And so we went to this place and we're sitting there and they, you know, it's like there's a dance floor and they've got these makeshift light fixtures, you know, that come down that look kind of like drag strip. You know, those drag strip things. You know,
right.
Christmas trees, they call them. And they were on hydraulics, so they'd come down low and they go back up. And we're sitting over, at a couch, all sitting around in kind of a circle. And somebody brings over something to smoke. And Michael Jackson hands it to me. And I didn't look to see if he smoked any or not, but like somebody hands me a joint. And I'm like, oh, in Ohio, we can't afford marijuana. So myself, oh, I have some. So I took a nice big hit, and I'm looking around, everybody's just talking, they're all, like, real casual, and I'm thinking, well, I just might try a second one. You know, because, you know, we never had drugs. We couldn't afford them.
Right.
You know, it's like, it's part of the reason we didn't fit in Ohio, because we didn't like drugs, and we none of us owned a van, and we hated the Bulls, so.
Yeah. Well, it seems like you guys did all right without drugs.
So there's nothing for us to do there except entertain ourselves. So I take a couple of hits of this, and I pass it on. And this woman, Susan Bloomberg, or what is her name? Susan something.
Yeah.
I'll think of her name. She was in a couple of Warhol movies. And she was on the Blue Channel when the Screw Magazine guy did that thing where she was like this curly-haired Jewish girl with big tits that would sit there and was like an Ed McMahon on the Blue Channel back in the 70s.
Oh, boy.
Anyhow, so you can imagine my excitement. You know, an older woman, and I'm in my early 20s. And
you're in New York.
Yeah, I'm in New York. And,
yeah.
And
you're totally stoned.
Totally stoned. And so she goes out on the dance floor and she goes, come on and dance. I go, no, but I'll watch. So I come over and I'm watching her out there dancing and, you know, like Boogie Fever kind of music and
uh-huh,
all that stuff. And the light fixtures are turning around. There's like nine of these things that are like drag strip Christmas trees. And they're turning around and they, on the hydraulics, they come down low enough so that they can be, you know, like in the middle of the dancers, you know. It was like, everybody had to kind of make up what disco lights were back in the 70s because it wasn't worked out yet.
Yeah.
Anyhow, these lights are turning around and they're going really fast, but they're kind of like out of control and they're lowering them and I'm like watching these things come down and I'm like, oh my God, those things look like weed whackers. Like out of control. The guy is going way too fast.
Yeah.
You know, and they're turning way too fast and they're like, not just in the straight, they're not just straight up and down, but now they're like, they're like, why not kind of at an angle? They're doing a big circle. They lower them down. They start hitting people in the head.
Are you kidding?
People are getting hit in the heads with these things, and they're going really fast. And there's like, I'm seeing like 12 or 14 people go down all at once.
You're totally bullshitting me. You're serious.
This thing comes down and hits, and I'm like, oh my God. She's like over there, and she doesn't see it. She's like looking at me going, come on, come on. Like making these motions for me to come over and dance with her. And I'm totally, like, just pissing my pants, looking around.
Yeah.
Like, oh my God, what's going on? And I'm yelling to her. She's like, what, what? She comes over and she goes, what did you say? And then I look at that, and I turn around, and we both look, and there's nothing there.
Nice.
And she goes, are you okay? And I go, I just saw the weirdest thing. She goes, you didn't smoke any of that angel dust, did you? I go, what's that?
Nice.
I go, what's angel dust? She goes, oh, no. So then the next thing I know, she's like, got me by the wrist, and she's like dragging me over to the table, and she's going, talking to us, and she's going, he's smoking I gotta get rid of him, you know. So the next thing I know, she's got me in a taxi cab, and she takes me back to the hotel, and it's basically, you know, she had come over earlier and changed into my clothes and left her clothes in the bathroom, and I thought, okay, this is going to be sweet. By the time we got back there, and I'm tripping my granddaughter, she's like, okay, come out. She grabs her stuff, says, I'll send you your clothes back tomorrow. And she just, like, locked me in my room, and I sat there and fried for the rest of the night on angel dust.
Oh, man.
And the one thing that it made me realize is angel dust, I got to say, is that anybody that's doing it, I could totally believe any of the weird stories you hear about
it. Oh, I know.
People aren't doing that anymore.
The first time I ever smoked marijuana, I found out later it was laced with angel dust. It fucked me up. And I thought that's what pot was. Like, I thought pot did that to you all the time. And I was like, Jesus Christ, this shit is crazy.
How can people do it?
Yeah, because I was in my room. I was like 13. I was listening to Metallica's Ride the Lightning or something. And these little bunny rabbits were playing it in these leather jackets in front of my stereo. It was nuts. I was like, fuck. So, I know what you mean. That's all I'm saying.
So
that's the story of Andy Warhol and Angel Dust.
that was my Andy Warhol Angel Dust story.
Nice.
But besides that, I still, you know, it's like, I just like the idea that he worked in different mediums.
Right.
And, took advantage of technology in a good way, in a creative way.
Right. Well, and you probably share a relationship with him beyond that, just in that you're both interested in printmaking so much, right?
Yeah. I mean, that was, you know, of course.
Yeah. God, I don't know where to go with this interview after talking about that fucking shit.
So all these pictures are just derivations of that one weird experience.
Oh, really?
They all spawn from the
weed whacker.
So anyhow, so I get to do music for films, and I love it.
Yeah.
That, sometimes it's really great. Sometimes it's just a day job.
Yeah.
But, you know, like working with Wes Anderson, that's more than a day job. That's a good experience.
Yeah, I was amazed at that at the Royal Tenenbaums. Actually, I thought it was an astounding film. The guy cracked me up to no end. I mean, his sense of humor is just so peculiar, and it seemed like such a great fit to see your name up there with the way that movie went visually, and to see you sort of in my mind, like behind the controls, like a mad scientist working out this music that I was hearing was great, and I really, really loved what you did with that film musically.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. You know what? It has a lot to do with the movie, too. It's like, you can bring a lot to a good movie.
Yeah.
To a movie that resonates with you. And it's, you know, there's some movies where it doesn't matter, you know, it's a day job. That's all it could ever be.
Right.
But you know, it's like, but I've been doing this artwork, and I started doing prints here at my studio, and I thought, you know, I can't really follow people like Robert Williams. You know, they do some. He's pretty amazing at what he does, and what he is very specific. And what I do is something totally different than what he does.
Right.
But he's interested in like the Tony Schiavone kind of galleries, and
right.
He wants to sell stuff for a lot of money, and I'm lucky I got a day job that pays the rent.
Yeah.
So with this tour, the reason it was called Home Front Invasion was, is it Home Front or Homeland?
I think it's called Home Front, yeah.
Home Front Invasion was because, in my mind, what my goal is with these shows, and I'm doing them at very small galleries all around the country, I want to juxtapose magazine to look for galleries.
Yeah.
I was looking for like smaller galleries that were owned by younger people usually.
Yeah.
People that were still in it, not because they're trying to score, you know, a Frank Stella, you know, for a lawyer or a bank or something, but people that were still in it because they loved visuals.
Yeah. That's what I love about Fuse Gallery, actually. I don't know if you've had a chance to visit that place, but there's a bar attached to it called Lit that me and my friends hang out and drink at all the time, and they always have really great shows, and, you know, they've had people like Winston Smith in there and different other, like, fantasy artists and stuff like that, and then when I saw that your work was going to be there, it seemed like a really great fit, and I was actually really surprised because, you know, I've listened to Devo since I was in junior high school, and I didn't know that you even made visual art until this whole thing happened, and then after doing some online research, I realized you've been doing this for years, and that you were actually a visual artist, and I got a lot more caught up on, you know, where you've come from with all this stuff, and I think, from my perspective, having, you know, just been a fan of the Fuse Gallery, I can see that you've made the right decision with that. Have you been out there at all, or seen it?
I haven't been to Fuse except for online, and I've had people that are friends of mine went over and checked it out first. But I found out about them through Juxtapose magazine because they're just, you know, I was looking for these kind of more, you know, like on, you know, more current and people that were dealing with, you know, the audience that's going to like my art, it's not going to be lawyers. And even people with, I even start losing fans once they start having kids. Because then it's problematic thinking about if they want to have, you know, like a, you know, whatever, a goat with a, you know, a bomb strapped to its ass.
Yeah.
Walking through a security in an airport, you know.
Right.
On the wall, you know, in a baby's bedroom, or, you know, in a room where they have to explain it to little kids. So it's like the people that are buying my artwork aren't lawyers and they aren't bankers.
Yeah.
They're like just kids that are in school.
Yeah.
So I tried to price the artwork as cheap as I could.
Yeah.
And basically, it just pays for the frame. I found a framer in the valley in California that gives me this deal where, because I'm framing like 500 pieces of art with him.
Yeah.
And so he gave me a really good deal that's like about maybe a sixth of what it would cost to get a frame normally, and that's all I charge.
That's cool.
And the artwork is just, so people are buying the artwork for cheaper than it would cost to buy a frame. Actually, you can come buy my stuff and then take the frame apart and put something else in it, and it's cheaper than going to a framer.
Nice sales pitch there.
Yeah, it's probably better if you don't print it, because there will be people that will go, hell yeah, I need a frame for my art.
No, I mean, that's just, I think that's why I'm really glad that I interviewed you like this, because I really appreciate the down-to-earth quality of that gallery as well as what you do. It's modest in scale and ambitious in that it's, you know, been so long enduring, but it's just nice to see another aspect of what you do that aligns with, you know, the visual arts, and it's good to see that you've continued to do it after art school, you know, despite being very, very successful with, you know, music.
Well, these here can still be called or considered originals in the print world, because if you do an edition that's under 8,
yeah,
we're under 12 usually, you can still call them originals rather than call them from an edition. And
right.
Most of them I only print 2, so
right.
I keep one for my archive. I have one of each of them, and then I sell, you know, sell the other one. So most of the pieces in the show, or a large portion of the pieces in the show are going to be pieces that if you buy it, you're the only person that has one.
Cool.
And it's me.
Yeah.
So it is like having an original for like a few hundred dollars rather than thousands of dollars.
Very nice.
And the reason I called the show Homefront Invasion was because I wanted my artwork to invade people's homes around the world.
Right.
And I like the idea that by this time next year, there'll be like, I don't know, somewhere between 400 and 800 pieces of artwork hanging on walls in the world that I printed myself.
Right.
Here in my studio.
Well, not to mention, you know, I think a lot of kids across the country are probably going to have your music playing in their, you know, in their bedrooms.
Yeah, let's make it a one-stop shopping here. Yeah.
Yeah. The worldwide all fronts invasion of Mark Miller's ball. That's cool though. I'm about out of tape here, so
okay.
I think we'll call it done. But I really, really appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to talk to me about this. Would you mind if I use some of the images from the show and the?
I would be delighted.
Cool. I've got this.
If you have trouble getting copies of them, let me know.
Actually, Michael sent me a.
He'll send you all sorts of stuff.
Yeah, he sent me a big CD full of stuff. I'm looking at a bunch of them right now. But I've got this picture of you in your music studio holding up a print. Would you mind if I use that?
You can use anything, sure.
Okay, cool. All right, I just wanted to get that little formality out of the way. I didn't want you to see anything out there you didn't want printed or anything. Okay.
Good luck with you with writing career.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, I'm a performance and visual artist myself, so it's what I mostly do. But I just kind of do this stuff on the side for fun.
Yeah.
I got the opportunity to, so it's pretty cool. But yeah.
Thank you for including me.
No problem. The issue should be this. This is for the fall issue. We just changed the magazine's just changed over to a bi-monthly thing, so I think it'll be the September October issue. So
okay.
My deadline's the 15th. I think it'll be out like September 1st. Whenever it does, I'll get a hold of Michael and you all and get you some copies. Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Cool. No problem.
Mark.
Oh, my roommate Shelley wants to say hi. I'm sorry.
I'm just passing through. I just wanted to say thank you for Devo. I grew up with you, and I'm just a big fan. That's all.
Okay, eat your vegetables, Shelley.
I do. I'm a vegetarian.
Okay.
But I'm out. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks, Mark.
I had to be able to say it.
Yeah. I hope this was recording.
Good.
45 minutes.